Thanks. It's great to be here with you.
So you say that one of the reasons that you came to the University of Utah was because the willingness and the desire of the university to innovate with technology was something that really appealed to you. Can you tell us more about that?
Yeah, the strength the University of Utah has is in their faculty and their people, and our ability to add people together, almost like bits of a computer. You are able to have more megabits of information working when you link to other people in the university. Coming from a group of people who pioneered to get to Salt Lake, they've had this spirit of working together and connecting together and being humble enough to work together. That spirit is pervasive in this area in Utah. And so with that, in our genetics, I guess, here in Utah, linking to some of the brightest minds in the technologies I'm building was a very frictionless effort.
Nice. So dentistry, you know, it is a very hands-on sort of activity, but it's interesting to hear about the intersection of dentistry and technology, which is something that you were always interested in. And what was the genesis of that interest in technology and innovation for you specifically with dentistry?
In dentistry, when I started getting started in dentistry, I was probably 2 years into dental school, and I thought, oh my gosh, I think I made the wrong choice. It felt like there was a lot of rules for me.
Yeah.
I grew up in a family. My father was an artist, and my mother was very free-spirited. And so I got 2 years in with a lot of debt already due to schooling and just felt like, oh my gosh, I've made the wrong choice. And then I met a researcher at the dental school who said, you know what, there's a lot more to dentistry than just what you're doing working in mouths. There's a lot of ideas you could open up. And his name was Aaron Weinberger. He was at the time working with beta defensins in the mouth. And if you think about HIV, he did a lot. HIV has a hard time surviving in the mouth due to beta defensins. So he was pioneering a lot of work. And he said, you've got to come think with me in my lab. I started doing some thinking alongside him and other thinkers and got really addicted to building technologies in dentistry. And did that for about 5 to 7 years. Worked on generating new ways of doing procedures. Entered the VA system, which is a little bit less innovative. It's very bureaucratic, but still in that space, we were able to have a revolution of innovation in systems. And in building in that kind of closed space, we were able to impress the University of Utah, who said, "Come think with us in the School of Dentistry," which was just maybe a semester underway. And so since then, we've had the opportunity to build tooth technology that, unlike other technology, it can sense molecules in your... It's designed to sense molecules in the body, see a reactive protein that may be building up when you're having a heart attack. You may want to detect glucose if you're diabetic. And so this tooth, this implantable tooth, which is in both the blood and the mouth, can sense saliva. The ideal would be for it to sense blood too, and it can detect different molecules in the body that you want it to, and then can send information to space. So if your father-in-law is having a heart attack, doesn't know he's about to, while he's walking through the Uintas, it can send that message to space, send it back to your care provider and say, we've got to get somebody at this geo position on the planet to help them before the heart attack. So that was one of the early technologies we started building with Florian Schulzbacher and Tomas Petelins, and it caught a lot of attention. Meanwhile, we started building other technologies in artificial intelligence for detecting cavities, which is really nerdy but super fun. Then we started getting a lot of press on the work we were doing with virtual reality. Hardly anything has got as much attention as what we've done in virtual reality. It's taken off. And then also augmented reality. So those are some of the early technologies we built in just the last 5 years, connecting to really smart people at the U.
So I was told that one of the most painful things that you could possibly go through is if you're a burn victim and you're having your bandages changed. And we had heard of a virtual reality application, totally immersive experience where the child in a burn unit who's having their bandages changed is, you know, they think they're on an iceberg in this ice water with these polar bears swimming around them, and they're able to do that without any medications at all. And it's really evolved from the game stature to really being some useful utilities and tools for people like you.
Yeah, one of the researchers at the university Greg Boulage, he's developed a similar virtual reality module where he's a pharmacist. He built it so we could reduce the amount of opioids being delivered to human beings. He's figured out a virtual reality module fused with certain music that will allow you to obtund pain, to decrease pain levels very significantly. Similar to what they're doing, they're creating a situation where the child in the iceberg scenario is feeling more cool, if I'm understanding what you're getting.
Yes.
So he would be, Greg Boulage's work is doing something therapeutic with virtual reality, and also the Gap Lab at the University of Utah. For people who have diabetes, in the early stages, they may not take it as seriously because they're not towards the tail end where they're having their feet amputated. By having some of these situational empathy modules, we're able to introduce them in the Gap Lab to pre-diabetic situations that would become very bad situations 10, 20 years later that you wouldn't be able to empathize with unless you had it happen to you. So using virtual reality to help us induce feelings of empathy is very, very, a very likely place that virtual reality will be a standalone technology that will be valuable. Today we had a conference with a gentleman from India who's interested in intimate partner violence and rape and acid throwing and using virtual reality to help protect women from toxic masculinity and other problems that they face there. Also here with suicide and elements like that that are quite socially disturbing, that we might be able to bring down the rates of some of those more terrible things that we hear about.
So providing an immersive experience for somebody in the dental chair who's always had anxiety and has always maybe they haven't even gone to a dentist for 5 years because they're afraid of going into that environment. Besides that type of thing, the procedures that you perform are so precise. Can virtual reality be used as a teaching tool to help young dentists learn some of these procedures?
Right. So the question being, can the virtual reality simulate with enough fidelity to be able to translate skills? So our early work over the last 3 years has shown that we're working both with the occipital lobe, with us thinking about how the eyes take in information that surgeons would need to be able to be very precise with, and then also hand skills, which go through the cerebellum, the pons, and those parts of the brain. The simulators that we've been working with, we've been really able to demonstrate, as well as other universities. UCLA did some work recently with orthopedic surgeons, which is worth looking at, where they did show data that their surgeons are doing better faster when they go through virtual reality simulation training. Our work in specifically, let's say, dentistry, we created a haptic, which is basically input instead of coming in through the eyes, it comes in through the hands and you feel pressures. It's a simulated pressure system that as you have the virtual reality system on your eyes and you hold the haptic device in your hand, it makes you feel like you're cutting a patient's tooth preparatory for a crown. We had students test in book learning, PowerPoint learning, and video learning, and then compared it to learning in virtual reality. And those students who had the opportunity to learn in the simulation of virtual reality were able to be what we call clinically acceptable much more rapidly than those who learned in traditional forms of learning, which have been on the earth for, you know, thousands of years. We've been dealing with books for quite a long time. So being able to compete with something that's been around for a long time is quite compelling.
Lynn, don't you love technology?
Yes. This is incredible. So when you talk about the training with virtual reality for getting that accuracy with your hands, talking about less than a millimeter of accuracy or margin of error, less than a millimeter in these. That is incredible what you're training the hands to do. As we know, hands, I can just shake a little bit and it can be more than a millimeter. So,
yeah, Lynn, you're exactly right. Our a traditional crown that we would teach a student today, the portion of the crown that fits the tooth is called the margin. And that margin has no margin of error, no pun intended. It's supposed to be closed by about 50 microns. And so we're dealing with a very, very small space. We generally teach our students to do cuts that are anywhere from 1 millimeter to half a millimeter. And so that specificity of your hand is really precise. I mean, it really is. So,
well, and the other thing is I'm thinking about you know, let's say getting a root canal with a student practicing on me, which I don't know how it typically goes when you're not using VR or augmented reality, but the willingness to have people be sort of pilot testing these young students in dental school, it's a little scary. I would really feel much better about them having practiced in the way that you have introduced and helped develop.
Yeah, I appreciate that. We do believe that we can get our students out of the school with more skills. And the reason is, surprisingly, sleep cycles. The brain, particularly the cerebellum, it processes memory at night. So as you're learning to ride a bike, you ride and you practice throughout the day. You don't get much better throughout that day, but you get back on the bike the next day and you're like, wow, now I'm suddenly able to do this. The cerebellum is processing at night and it's consolidating memories then. So our students don't get into the clinic. Most students don't get into the clinic until 2 years into their dental career, which means 2 years of lost sleep cycles. So if we're able to get them into the simulators with absolutely no risk to the patients, because they're all virtual patients, and have them start going through the motorics over and over in the virtual simulator, that induces more sleep cycles. They get more hand skills, so they can be precise down to those small margins. The concept you brought up about root canals, Lynn, is compelling. We did some work, and I want to share this because virtual reality won't be a way to solve all learning problems. We did some work in virtual reality for root canals, and we found that unless we break the work up into work being educational work up into small little packets, if you have too many things for the students to learn, virtual reality doesn't actually advantage us. You have to break it down into, I would call them atomic, not molecular, atomic skills, where it's just one basic skill. So if the root canal is 5 to 15 steps, we'll teach them one with virtual reality over and over until they get it. Then they can do the next step. But if you do all the molecules of 15 steps all at once, our data shows that it doesn't work. So virtual reality won't be a silver bullet. You have to know when to pull the trigger when. So where we found it to be most useful in root canals is we can actually now see in 3D your tooth, Lynn. Say you needed a root canal. We could see your actual tooth in 3D and imagine all the chambers of the tooth. In fact, we've gotten so good at it now that when we teach students, we allow them to actually walk through the tooth about the size of a convenience store. So we'll take your actual natural tooth, blow it up 300 times, and let the students traverse through it and allow that part of the brain, which has evolved for millennia, where we're really good with spatial awareness, and then they actually execute the root canal. It's a completely different type of imaging when you're walking through the patient's tooth before you do the root canal. Who else is doing that? We're grateful we have the opportunity to do it at the University of Utah.
Well, that sounds pretty good.
Yeah.
So most people have basic medical insurance, and most of those people don't have dental insurance, and these dental procedures are expensive. So when you were talking about crowns a couple of minutes ago, when will we get to the point where we're so precise in the making of our initial crown, that we won't have to send the thing out to be reproduced, and we'll be able to save some money, and we won't have to come back to the dentist a second time?
Right. We're seeing a broader adoption across the country in digital dentistry. Most curriculum today for dental schools require students to understand how to intraorally scan, where they'll take a three-dimensional scan of the mouth and it'll create an STL file, which can then be printed or milled. And so most universities today are teaching that. The cost is becoming less and less expensive for that type of service. But it's still there's still some complexities, and surprisingly, it's not the technology; it's the social that you have to train your personnel how to use that technology in the office. And since the dentist needs to be cutting teeth and not printing or milling, it becomes still a little bit difficult. So it's still more cost effective for us to send those digital files, those STL files, to laboratories who are set up to do that large amount of work. But we are seeing a broader adoption of that intraoral scanning and milling inside of offices all over the United States and also the globe, and we'll see it continue to decrease. We've seen the advent of printing make a small dent, but really the milling has made the biggest impact. We've been doing CAD/CAM for quite a long time in dentistry, but since 2008, when we saw the economy change us, the dental profession, from gold and metals, which became far more cost prohibitive around the recession, we moved more to ceramics, which lend themselves really well to CAD-CAM technologies where you can mill those out quite easily, sinter them in a furnace, and put them in a patient's mouth in your office. So since 2008, we've seen a massive upswing of that technology.
Dr. Durham, early onset Alzheimer's and Alzheimer's is a debilitating disease for people and for their families and loved ones. And fortunately, there's been tremendous inroads made in trying to understand Alzheimer's better. And I read this morning that researchers have also linked periodontal disease with an increased buildup in the neurological hallmarks that make up Alzheimer's. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, and my specialty is prosthodontics, so I'm more of a specialist in building and replacing teeth. The periodontist, my colleagues would be able to speak more intelligently about that. But we are seeing some of the most compelling
what is this connection.
Right, we're seeing this mouth-body connection, which is very, very important. Where in the past we may not have paid as much attention to it. But there's been research done by insurance groups who have found that if people just go and get their teeth cleaned regularly, that they're less likely to have heart attack. They're less likely to have a host of other problems. There's a massive amount of links to the periodontium, which is very surprising. The gums harbor an enormous amount of bacteria, as you might expect. That bacteria can make its way into the body, and it can form aggregate plaques onto the heart valves and create just a host of problems. We can also see problems with people who have joint replacements. So there's some issues related to the mouth and the system as a whole, and one of those is the Alzheimer's. So we've seen early research in the last year or two where they're linking the mouth to Alzheimer's as well, and we'll learn more about that. In my early days, I was doing research studies on preterm birth. So we found that there were some links between the state of your mouth and preterm birth, which has unusual problems for babies being born early. So quite a few links to the system and the mouth.
Very interesting. So in the beginning, and sort of related to what you've talked about now, the connection between what's going on in the body and your mouth, were the detection of certain enzymes and molecules and even proteins present in the mouth that this prosthodontic tooth that you've talked about. So switching gears a little bit into that to talk about what this implant can pick up. It's kind of crazy. And it reminds me, John, remember when we talked to the gentleman from Provo about his smart toilet, which was the same sort of idea, but one's a mouth, one's a toilet, right?
Yeah.
But again, picking up and being able to monitor and measure different things going on in the body from another use and application of technology. So talk about the prosthodontic.
Right. We're very interested in the capacity to take the teeth beyond their general assumed function of crushing food. So beyond grape, nuts, and bacon, the teeth also serve as one of the few places in the human body where an implantable device can be placed both outside the mouth, outside the body, which is in the mouth, and inside the body, which is in through the gums. If you think about that, putting an implant anywhere else in the body and have it somewhat stick out would infect, would encapsulate, would be inflamed, and you'd shortly have to take it out. But for whatever reason, even though the mouth is teeming with bacteria, we're able to successfully place dental implants partially in the mouth and partially in the body. So we call that transcutaneous, and we're one of the few places on the body that can do that. So being armed with that knowledge and being a specialist in dental implants, I became very hyper interested in taking advantage of that. When you think about a USB is partially in the computer and partially out.
Yeah.
So using that technology as a way to have a USB into the body became very compelling to us. So with precedent work by Florian Schulzbacher, who was interested in seeing if we could start sensing things for firefighters, if there was if there was not enough air in the space you're in, that it would be detected earlier than a firefighter's brain could detect it would be a useful application. He was building those systems out with hydrogels. We connected at the university. Now, Florian is, he's no dummy, my goodness. He created the brain-computer interface, right? So if there's people on the planet using the brain-computer interface right now, they should be referencing Florian Schulzbacher as the inventor of it in his company, BlackRock Microsystems. With Florian, we started working with hydrogels to start detecting. The first thing we started detecting was glucose. Then we got some funding because opioids had been a big deal. We got funding for fentanyl. We're also able to do ionic strength and other things. We're doing this work on a benchtop. We've got a lot of roadblocks before we can get FDA approval and putting devices in the mouth that can detect things and also bring the systems down. We need funding to be able to provide that type of technology. But I think the simple solution we were thinking originally was for diabetes, or I would say more particularly chronic disease. More people die due to chronic disease than anything else on the planet. I mean, it's a massive human killer. So if we can detect those molecules earlier on, then great. And what better way to do it than a USB that has a way to take information out every single day? Why is that compelling? Well, when we take our blood samples once every 6 months, a lot of stuff has been lost over that 6 months. If you can do it every single day, every minute of the day, that's when you really start harnessing the power of that technology for us to be able to say, there's a small trend taking place that's leading to these issues of cancer or other things. We should probably take action earlier than later. So that's one of the novel capacities that this technology will empower.
And so where are you in the development of this implant?
Well, we've received tremendous support from a group called Imagine Perfect Care. Imagine Perfect Care is one of the most beautiful things that University of Utah has ever conceived. It was done at a time with Vivian Lee where she approved the idea of creating ideas. So to me, one of the most special things in science are ideas. They don't cost us any. They cost a little bit to make them, but then they can scale all across the planet and they make us better. She decided that she would create an idea tank. And Imagine Perfect Care was funding for people who could come up with ideas that would make the world better. So Imagine Perfect Care funded us a number of times to start building this technology. With that funding and some other funding, we've been able to reduce it to a benchtop model where we've proven that the technology works. We're now at a state where we're building like the Invisalign or straightening trays that you'd use for your teeth. We've got the technology reduced down to something you can take in and out of the mouth and sense what's going on in the body. Ultimately, we'd like to be able to be into the implant where it's sensing the blood, but right now we're able to sense what's going on in the saliva. When you think about saliva, it's kind of like the plasma portion. It's the wet white portion of the blood. The red blood cells don't go through the saliva glands, but a lot of other molecules do. So we can sense a tremendous amount of information just by what's floating in the saliva. So snap that retainer in and start detecting what's going on is where we're at right now. So we're at that level.
Transcutaneous. And this is sort of a thing that we've been seeing, a movement towards taking personal responsibility in your healthcare. So let's say you have one of these implanted things, teeth, right? And it's checking your blood. Then you could monitor that yourself. Would this have the ability to be able to network directly from your mouth to a certain home network and jump into your computer so you can start holding on to that data and analyzing it and looking at trends?
Right. In that regard, it would be like some of these smartwatches meets the mouth, right, where you could get that data in real time. Currently, we have infrastructure at the U where we started talking with people who are interested in the systems in healthcare, and they would describe it like this. More people go to the dentist than they do their primary care provider. You go get your cleanings every 3 to 4 months. So the dentist could check out the data, could give recommendations to seeing other healthcare providers. So it just gives the United States a way to bring down their cost, their big cost loss due to chronic diseases by having an interface regularly to detect what's going on, to see the trends. So that data could be pouring in all the time. You could get a notification on your computer that your glucose is out of check and you need to do something about it. But also when you go to the dentist could act as a primary provider, not a primary care provider, but a primary interface to say, here's what's going on. These are the trends we've been seeing. We'd recommend you see these healthcare providers. So yes, the data could be something as simple as like a smartwatch in the mouth, right? Metaphorically speaking, but then we could also use human systems to help us reinforce and decrease chronic disease costs in America.
So you've helped us understand, Dr. Durham, technologies that were not available 10 years ago and what their possible applications are today. What future technologies are out there in the next 10 or 15 years that you're looking forward to getting a hold of?
Our work right now is in the next 3 years will be augmented reality. It will be managing three-dimensional space. You'll see a lot of work that'll start helping us digitized space. And the big thing will be, we believe right now will be the artificial intelligence, machine learning. We see that as a system that can generate ideas, and that is a meta idea. So the patenting process or funding are ways that we can infuse ideas. Artificial intelligence will allow us to also infuse ideas without humans being present or within conjunction with humans. Anytime you get a meta idea like the railroad, it allowed ideas to transfer and be born. Those big meta ideas, they always transform the planet. So in the next 3 to 5 years, you'll see AI. In the next 10 years, you'll for sure see AI take a significant leap. So I would say in healthcare, since that's the world that I live in, healthcare will be greatly impacted by artificial intelligence. The most impressive work we've seen in dentistry is in the action of artificial intelligence to detect cavities. As good as x-rays are, x-rays don't show sometimes up to 20% of small lesions. And the trick is to be able to watch them over time. So if an artificial intelligence can detect in x-rays what the human eye is incapable of seeing, it would be able to let us know earlier on, this is a lesion that needs a certain type of fluoride application and decrease the disease of cavities for people who don't even know that that lesion is forming because it's so hard to see on the x-ray. So that's a practical application of what's impressive right now. The AI is able to detect lesions at a decent rate. In January 2018, papers in dermatology were showing AI was outperforming dermatologists in detecting certain skin lesions. And we believe we'll see that trend in many applications in identifying unique lesions on the body. So that's a segue of where we'll probably go in the next 10.
We show our smart machines 100,000 pictures, and it just grabs all of this and is looking at and comparing things that a normal person wouldn't be, or a normal professional would not be able to do.
It's incredible. Well, Dr. Mark Durham, it's so nice that you joined us for Cool Science Radio. And I mean, for our listeners, this is what's going on at the School of Dentistry at the University of Utah. I'm sure I had no idea, and nor did our listeners. So thank you so much for joining us.
Absolutely. Thank you.